Dit is SBS Dutch.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with SBS Dutch on mobile, online and on radio.
Dit is SBS Dutch op mobiel, online en op radio.
Graag erkennen wij de traditionele eigenaren van het land van waar we vandaag uitzenden. SBS Dutch betuigt haar respect aan de Cammeraygal mensen en hun ouderlingen uit het heden en het verleden. Ook erkennen we de traditionele eigenaren van alle Aboriginal en Torres Strait Islander landen van waar u vandaag naar ons programma luistert. Hele goedemorgen. Het is woensdag 23 juli 2025. Welkom bij SBS Dutch, het Nederlandstalige radioprogramma van SBS. Mijn naam is Paulien Roesink. Het aankomende uur kunt u luisteren naar een gesprek met Simon Reich. Hij maakte, naar aanleiding van het verhaal van zijn Duitse vader, een podcast, theatervoorstelling en nu ook een documentaire over de naoorlogse migranten van Bongilla. Verder ook de tweede aflevering van onze nieuwe podcastserie Uncle Charlie, de onzichtbare held. Dit keer leren we daarin Uncle Charlie beter kennen. Dat en muziek en achtergronden bij het nieuws allemaal straks. Nu eerst de nieuwsflits. Dit is de SBS Nieuwsflits van woensdag 23 juli. Mijn naam is Paulien Roesink. Een wet om studieschulden te verlagen is het eerste wetsvoorstel dat in het 48e parlement wordt ingediend. De verkiezingsbelofte van Labour voorziet in een vermindering van 20% van de studieschuld voor 3 miljoen Australiërs, waarbij de inkomensgrens voor het afbetalen van de schuld wordt verhoogd naar $67.000. Een groep senatoren van One Nation heeft scherpe kritiek gekregen nadat ze zich gisteren tijdens een acknowledgement of country in de Senaatzaal tijdens de ceremoniële opening van het parlement de rug toekeerden. Een 15-jarige jongen is overleden en een andere tiener verkeert in kritieke toestand na een jetski-ongeluk op de Georges River in Sylvania in New South Wales. De hulpdiensten rukten gisteravond rond 6 uur uit nadat de jongens naar verluid een obstakel hadden geraakt en in het water waren beland. Een zitting van het Huis van Afgevaardigden van de Verenigde Staten is vervroegd gesloten vanwege oneenigheid tussen republikeinen over het onderzoek naar Jeffrey Epstein. Voorzitter Mike Johnson vindt dat de regering Trump ondanks druk van partijgenoten op eigen voorwaarden informatie moet mogen vrijgeven. Nieuws dan uit Nederland via de NOS. Rijkswaterstaat vermoedt dat er in deze maand 8 keer met opzet puin op de snelweg is gegooid bij Apeldoorn. Steeds werd het puin 's nachts gevonden, vlakbij een viaduct. Eerder deze week konden auto's en vrachtwagens de brokstukken niet ontwijken en liepen schade op. Al 7 keer eerder was het deze maand raak op de A50 in de buurt van Apeldoorn. De politie noemt het meer dan opvallend en is op zoek naar getuigen die meer weten. En goed nieuws, want de Nederlandse gasvoorraad is weer op peil. GasUnie meldt dat de gasbergingen voor ruim 54% vol zitten. Als het vullen van die bergingen in dit tempo doorgaat, moet er genoeg aardgas zijn voor een koude winter. In de Europese Unie was afgesproken om de gasbergingen per 1 juli voor zeker 47% vol te hebben. Maar in januari waarschuwde GasUnie nog dat de voorraden sneller opraakten dan in eerdere jaren vanwege toegenomen verbruik. Tot zover deze nieuwsflits. Volg de SBS Dutch podcast voor meer nieuws en achtergronden of bezoek onze website sbs.com.au/dutch. Gaan we verder met de achtergronden bij het nieuws. In het door werelderfgoed beschermde Shark Bay, 800 kilometer ten noorden van Perth, werkt een Malgana-vrouw aan het behoud van de biodiversiteit. Beschouwd als een van 's werelds grootste wildernisschatten, draagt zij een unieke verantwoordelijkheid die is doorgegeven door de elders die voor haar for country hebben gezorgd. Nalisha Oakley, een vrouw uit Malgana, werkt al 2 jaar als ranger. Haar kantoor is de op de werelderfgoedlijst staande Gadagudu, oftewel Shark Bay in West-Australië. De baai wordt beschouwd als een van 's werelds grootste wildernisschatten.
If you look around, like the landscapes, the colors, there's nowhere else in the world like Shark Bay.
Haar werk omvat het monitoren van de lokale fauna met behulp van een camera.
So we do lots of fauna and flora, eradication of feral animals. I do lots of camera monitoring and data, lots of fencing. And I also get to jump on board with the ERP, which is the Ecological Restoration Program over at Dirk-Hartel Island. And I've done a bit of work with the marine team down in Kensington and a few of the scientists over there as well.
Maar haar grootste passie in dit uitgestrekte gebied zijn mensen.
Favorite parts of my job is working with different people from different walks of life. The wildlife that I get to see and the country out here I get to show all the other guys that haven't been here.
Nelisha Oakley vertelt dat ze 2 jaar geleden als boswachter is begonnen om een betere band met het land te krijgen en een unieke verantwoordelijkheid te dragen die is doorgegeven door elders die voor haar voor country hebben gezorgd.
So I applied for the job because I wanted to be out on country more. I feel it's good for your soul. And I also feel it's up to us young guys to step up and do what our elders once did. I think the elders who have passed or who no longer have the ability to come out in country because they are quite elderly, they would be very, very proud of not just myself, but my cousins that work in the office as well. It was once upon a time them doing what we're doing.
Ze zegt dat veranderingen in de manier waarop het land wordt onderhouden de deur hebben geopend naar meer werkgelegenheid.
Obviously in the past years there wasn't as many opportunities, but with the whole joint management that's now in place, it's the perfect opportunity for any Morgana person to put their hand up and come out in country and help us.
Dit was een verhaal van Dan Rennie van NITV en Sam Dover voor SBS Nieuws, in het Nederlands vertaald door SBS Dutch.
SBS Dutch op mobiel, online en op radio.
Autoriteiten en experts adviseren reizigers in Australië om belangrijke veiligheids- en overlevingsmaatregelen te nemen wanneer ze afgelegen gebieden betreden. Het advies volgt naar aanleiding van een jonge Duitse backpacker die onlangs werd gevonden nadat ze 11 nachten had overleefd in de outback van West-Australië. De 26-jarige Carolina Wilga stootte haar hoofd toen ze de controle over haar auto verloor en verliet daarna haar auto. Ze worstelde met vrieskou en schaarse middelen voordat ze werd gered.
She spent one day with the car after it became bogged. And then she moved on from there. So she was essentially out in the wilderness for about 11 nights, which is significant. And just brings us back to how lucky she was that she was located safe and well and how thankful we are that we managed to find her. She basically looked at the direction of the sun and tried to head west, thinking that that would be her best bet of coming across someone or a road.
Aldus Jessica Securo, waarnemend rechercheur van West-Australië, onlangs tijdens een persconferentie. Ze beschreef gedetailleerd hoe de 26-jarige Duitse backpacker de brute beproeving van 12 dagen alleen in de outback overleefde. Carolina Wilga is inmiddels ontslagen uit een ziekenhuis in Perth na bijna 2 weken verdwaald te zijn geweest in de woeste natuur van WA. Ze werd behandeld voor uitdroging en aan lichte verwondingen, maar is inmiddels aangesterkt en herenigd met haar dierbaren. Rechercheur Securo zegt dat familieleden in Duitsland overweldigd waren.
We're in disbelief that a community can come together and just throw every resource at locating their daughter.
Vanuit het ziekenhuis onthulde Wilga waarom ze haar auto had achtergelaten. Ze had haar hoofd gestoten nadat ze de macht over het stuur was verloren en was in verwarring uit de vastgelopen auto gegaan. In een politieverklaring bedankte de backpacker ook de automobilist die haar heeft gevonden, evenals de politie, het zoekteam en het medisch personeel. Tania is degene die haar dus gevonden heeft. Ze vertelde aan ABC News over het moment dat ze Carolina zag.
I knew it was her straight away. I was coming back from Beacon because I've been down to pick up my trailer and she was on the side of the road waving her hands.
De Duitse vertrok uit haar geboorteplaats Castrop-Rauxel in Duitsland dus, met de droom om elke uithoek van dit uitgestrekte land te bezichtigen. Ze had 11 dagen gelopen, sliep in een grot en overleefde door te drinken van regenwater en plassen op de grond. Carol Ryan is de plaatsvervangend commandant van de Bush Search and Rescue Unit bij SES New South Wales. Voor avonturiers die in Australië willen reizen, raadt ze de trekmethode aan.
T-R-E-K, and it stands for tea, which is take everything you need. So that's going to be your food and your water. Take a little bit extra because you don't know if you're going to get delayed. Take a first aid kit, take some warm layers of clothes. Take a map and a compass or a good way of navigating. You might have a digital app, something like that. Make sure you've definitely then got your battery pack, a power bank for your phone to keep that phone working.
Ze zegt dat een papieren plattegrond heel handig is en dat er online goede paklijsten te vinden zijn.
Then the R is for register your intention, which is really just a fancy way of saying tell somebody where you're going. It's really important. So not only tell someone where you're going, but get specific. Tell them what track you're going to do, in what area, where you're going to leave your car, how long you're going to be, and let them know when you're back as well.
Ryan zegt dat een PBL, een Personal Locator Beacon, levensreddend kan zijn.
Then E stands for emergency communications. So you think about these wild places we have all across Australia. So many times we don't have mobile phone coverage. And, you know, having a way of communicating if something goes wrong or even just to let someone know you're running late is essential. So having a PLB, that's a personal locator beacon, it's a small device, fits in the palm of your hand. You can either buy them or rent them and they are absolute lifesavers.
En tot slot, maak je vertrouwd met de geplande reis.
Finally, we've got K, which is know your route and stick to it. So that's really about planning the trip that's right for you, for your experience, for the skills that you might have, for your level of fitness, and making sure you've got good information about that track that you're going to be doing as well. There's a great system in Australia. We've got the Australian Walking Track Grading System, and our tracks all across Australia are graded from 1 to 5, whereas 5 is really hard.
Sergeant Jim Armstrong is van de Emergency Operations Unit van de West-Australische politie. Hij zegt dat onderzoek en voorbereiding essentieel zijn. Van het laten weten aan iemand dat je gaat lopen, tot het kiezen van de juiste kleding en uitrusting.
One thing we recommend is offline mapping. So with most phones that have Google, there will be a mapping feature. And in the settings there, there's a thing called offline mapping. And what you can do is actually select an area that you're intending to go to, and you won't need to have phone coverage for your mapping to still function.
Volgens Sergeant Armstrong proberen mensen vaak dingen te doen waar ze niet voor uitgerust zijn.
We often see people attempting to do some serious four-wheel drive off-road adventures in their commuter vehicles, which are just totally unsuitable for the conditions. So it's important that your vehicle is suitable and it's also mechanically sound. And checked out before you leave. Now, with regard to your advanced planning for your trip, have a look at the resources you have and also have a self-rescue plan if something were to go wrong, and an idea of what you intend to do.
Het is altijd aan te raden om bij het voertuig te blijven, maar als dat niet mogelijk is, zo zegt hij, laat dan een duidelijk spoor achter.
If you reach a point at a track like a fork, or you have to make a decision to go left or right, leave a pile of rocks on the track with an arrow with some sticks just pointing in the direction you've gone. It just makes things a lot easier when we're out searching. If we come across something like that, we know which way to keep searching. When you are camped up for the night, consider a small fire. Obviously, we don't want fires to get out of control, but a small fire with the smoke and the heat can be easily spotted by a plane or a helicopter.
Sergeant Armstrong zegt dat elk reflecterend apparaat, zoals een spiegeltje, de aandacht kan vestigen op je locatie. Ondanks alles heeft de politie van West-Australië laten weten dat Carolina nog steeds van Australië houdt en plannen heeft om de rest van het land te zien, inclusief een reis naar de Oostkust. Dit was een bijdrage van Helena Krishnamoorthy en Chris Stan, in het Nederlands geproduceerd door SBS Dutch. Straks praten we met de documentairemaker Simon Reich over migrantenkamp Bongilla. Maar eerst de tweede aflevering van onze serie Uncle Charlie, de onzichtbare held.
Dit is SBS Dutch.
Vorige week vertelden historici en overlevenden over de Japanse luchtaanval op Broome op 3 maart 1942. En kregen we antwoord op de vraag waarom er op dat moment zoveel Nederlanders in Roebuck Bay waren. 2 jaar na de Japanse luchtaanval, waarbij meer dan 80 mensen omkwamen, ontving Bardiman Charles d'Antoine een medaille van de Nederlandse overheid voor het redden van 3 Nederlandse staatsburgers. Nu, 83 jaar later, heeft de Australische regering de dappere daad van Uncle Charlie nog steeds niet officieel erkend. In deze aflevering leren we Uncle Charlie kennen dankzij verhalen van zijn nicht Edie Wright en neven Neville d'Antoine, Douglas Clements en Charla Clements. Ook horen we van Josine van Achelen, een van de Nederlandse overlevenden die door Uncle Charlie werd gered. This podcast is produced on the lands of the Cammeraygal people. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and acknowledge the thousands of years of storytelling on this land. This episode also contains references to war and mentions and voices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have passed away.
It was very brave of him because there was a lot of oil on the water and it was also burning. And later I heard that there were also sharks swimming. I'm glad I didn't know that.
Josine van Achelen was only 6 years old when she found herself in the middle of the Japanese air raid on Broome in 1942.
At that moment, I didn't know who saved me. There were a lot of Navy men everywhere, so I thought a Navy man had saved me. But I didn't see the person. What is special is that he was there to save us. I wouldn't be here without him.
Nobody else was swimming there saving anybody else.
He was the only
one in the water that saved the people, yeah.
So your brother Charles d'Antoine saved little Josine van Achelen.
Yeah. I'm Pauline Roesink, and this is Uncle Charlie, the Invisible Hero, a podcast from SBS Dutch and NITV Radio. Over 3 episodes, I'll be speaking to historians, community members and survivors about what it means to be recognized for heroism, to figure out why Uncle Charlie didn't get officially recognized by the Australian government. Today we're hearing from Charles d'Antoine's family. This is episode 2, The Man We Know as Uncle Charlie. In 2015, Dutch documentary makers Pia van der Molen and Michiel Praal covered the 1942 Broome attack from the Dutch perspective. In this short documentary, they speak to Josine about her experience during the attack. At the time, she didn't know who saved her. So, the documentary makers put a call out on the local radio station. And with the help of the local community, they were able to link the story to Uncle Charlie. Here's Pia speaking to Uncle Charlie's sister, Auntie Peggy, who passed away in 2023.
And this is what she was when she was little.
Oh, goodness. Yes.
And I also have another picture, where she is now 81.
Oh, help.
There you are.
Yes, oh, that is nice.
And she wants me to say on her behalf how grateful she is that she was rescued, although we never know she was rescued by your brother.
Yeah, well, he was the only one that, you know, was swimming there and saved the people, the lady in the turn. There was nobody else. And as he was swimming, one of the women in the water was crying there, calling out in Dutch. He didn't know what she was saying. He kept swimming, then he stopped, turned around, went back to her and told her to put her hands on his shoulder.
Uncle Charlie's family have worked tirelessly to keep the story of his heroism alive. But there's a deeper reason why this story is so significant for the d'Antoine and Clements family. In 1967,
a referendum that gave the Commonwealth responsibility over Aboriginal affairs, passed. This change meant that First Nations people would be counted as part of the population and acknowledged as equal citizens. So, in 1942, when Uncle Charlie saved three people's lives, he wasn't considered an equal citizen of the land he was born on.
That interview where these Dutch journalists came out to One Arm Point to interview Mum, and they presented Mum with a photo of the young girl that he saved on that day in Broome. You're right in saying that the Dutch recognised Bob Charlie for his bravery. The Australian federal government hasn't recognised his deeds.
This is Douglas Clements, late Auntie Peggy's eldest son.
We always call Uncle Charlie Pop, Pop Charlie. That's as we know him. So Pop Charlie, him and his brother, Douglas, whom is unnamed, and his elder sister, Annie Laxey, they were born here on the Dead Peninsula at a place called Bulgan or Swan Point. And it's in the Umbadi country.
Uncle Charlie never had kids of his own. But from what we heard, it sounds like his nieces and nephews were like his own children.
From what I remember of the days of Pop, he was a sportsman. He used to play soccer. He liked playing soccer. He was a very good darts player. In fact, he went to the pub a lot. A lot of his beer that he drank, he won it through his darts game.
Douglas's brother Charla also has fond memories of Uncle Charlie.
So I was named after Uncle Charlie. His name was Charles Joseph Dantoin. You know, from when we were kids, he was in Darwin. He was sort of like, you know, pretty much a father figure to us. Look for us, be stuff for us, care for us. He used to provide supper Friday nights. He'd play darts, come home with a bow's chooket. It used to be a supper on Friday nights.
He'd come around every weekend, from what I remember. He was always around home on the weekend. And one of the things he could do, he could make boomerangs really good. He made his pair of boomerangs one day. We went out to a place called Buffalo Creek. And he tested them out. There was a low tide right out in the sand flats, and he let fly with his boomerangs. He used to take beautiful circle over there, just right out and back again, right at his feet. He was really good at it. One thing we know him for is he's a great seaman, and he knew some really great fishing spots. Took us out fishing one day, my wife and I, and we were going across out in the ocean off One Arm Point, and there's a big tide coming in, and we're going across this passage, and the tide's ripping through this passage, and this whirlpool broke in front of us. It would have been about, I don't know, 20 foot across, and we went straight into this whirlpool. He turned the boat around, and we just went around and around, and he gunned the motor, and we just pulled straight out of the whirlpool and come out over the top as if nothing had happened. It was an experience. He was that kind of seaman. He was just so confident.
We grew up, when I say we, all our cousins, all Uncle Charlie's nieces and nephews, we grew up with this story of Uncle Charlie. And a lot of Broome kids grew up with this story of Uncle Charlie.
Edie Wright, who we met in the first episode, wrote all about Uncle Charlie's life in a children's book called Charlie's Swim. She's pretty familiar on what happened on the 3rd of March in 1942.
Uncle Charlie's job was to clean and refuel the flying boats that were coming down from Dutch East Indies, and they were landing in Broome, and they were refueling in Broome and resupplying and then flying on to Sydney and Melbourne to the eastern states, and he'd help refueling the planes. So that was his job, and he was moving. As soon as he cleaned one plane, he'd move on to the next plane, and he'd clean that and get it ready. And that was his job on that fateful day when the Japanese, they strafed Broome and attacked the flying boats that were anchored in Roebuck Bay, full of military, Dutch military people, their families and children.
Charla also spent many nights asking his Uncle Charlie what happened that day. He remembers Uncle Charlie describing the zero planes flying over and shooting the flying boats he was working on, and how his instinct told him to swim to land.
And the people in the water swimming around him, singing out, helping, help, you know, I can't swim. He swam past the young mother and her child, and he told them that, you hang on to my shoulders, you know, hang on to my shoulders and kick with me. And we'll try and swim back to shore. She held onto his shoulders, and the child held onto her mother's shoulder as she could, and they started swimming. Now the planes came back, started shooting up the planes. They were shooting up people in the water, you know, and she said, we've got to dive underwater before they die so they don't shoot us. But she was scared of the water. She tried to pull him back, you know, stop him from diving, but they managed to make it.
After the event, after the war died down, it was the Dutch that acknowledged his bravery. It was the Dutch that awarded him medals and an open invitation to the Netherlands by the then reigning queen. It was the Humane Society that awarded him an official certificate acknowledging his bravery. But the Australian government, or WA government, did nothing.
Uncle Charlie's nephew Neville mentioned that the story didn't interest him as a child.
And it wasn't until later on, when I was helping him clean out his house, that at the bottom of under his bed, I was cleaning it out, and I opened it up, and I thought, you know, maybe this, I was worried about pythons being under his bed. But on the bottom of this case was this certificate of merit from the Royal Humane Society. And I was a young man then, and I began to get very interested in what did he do that warranted this certificate of merit. You know, Uncle Charlie, being the man that he is, a very humble man, and he didn't talk too much about it, but my dad, who was, you know, he has living memory of that event, would tell me, spit the stories about this thing. And it was then we took the certificate to the Fremantle Museum and asked them, can they look at restoring it for as much, as best as they could, and they were quite willing to do that. So we had that framed, they took it back to Uncle Charlie, and, you know, he almost burst into tears because, you know, nobody gives him anything, you know, like, you know, this was a great honour for him. The certificate of merit was signed in July of 1944, the 17th day of July 1944, and it was to honour him for events for the Roebuck Bay bombing of Broome, and it says in here, the Derby truck driver aged 23 in rescuing a woman and child and her child from drowning in Roebuck Bay in Broome, Western Australia on March the 3rd, 1942. You know, so that was only 2 years difference between that. And then the Dutch awarded him a medal. This was later on. And it's a medal with a red and yellow ribbon. And it's the medal for honourable medal of charitable assistance. And it's one of the oldest bravery awards in the Kingdom of the Netherlands. I think 50 years later, there's the second award that came from that. And it's a medal from the 18th NERAF. But it's a joint Dutch and Australian bomber squadron of World War II. But the sad thing about all of this is that you had the Kingdom of Netherlands acknowledging the bravery that he showed and what he did. And you had the Majesty the King, you know, the Humane Society. So nothing actually coming from the Australian government, which is quite sad. But it didn't change my admiration for Uncle Charlie. And stuff like that, but I thought he should be acknowledged for what he did for somebody that he never even knew.
Evie has similar thoughts on what decorations Australia has given to Uncle Charlie.
I have seen the memorial statues that they have out at Town Beach, which overlooks the bay. And I've seen those, I think, there's at least about eight of them, where there are the voices of people on these inscriptions. Uncle Charlie's one. There's a few Dutch survivors at the time they were able to get snippets from. There was Gus Winkle. But that's the memorial that I know of. Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit in an article in about 1942 written by, it must have been the superintendent of native welfare, and basically it said that, you know, he is deserving of being a white man for his bravery act. Now, that was so condescending, degrading, that little piece of information, but that was all that I have seen. And the family certainly haven't heard of any recognition.
Now, knowing that she might have been the one who was saved by your brother and looking at the picture, what do you feel here? What do you feel inside?
Oh, now we're very proud of him. He's not here to do all this. He should be here, not me.
Yeah. Yeah.
The word humble came up a lot when we asked his family to describe how Uncle Charlie felt about the awards he received. But when diving deeper, it seemed as though Uncle Charlie didn't even feel like he deserved these accolades.
He always remembered that particular day, and sad, from sad memories, because when he was in the water, he saved the woman and he saved the child. And at the same time, there were other women and children yelling out to be saved. And he had to ignore them. He had to swim away from them, get away from them. Otherwise, they would have all died. That really bugged him. He always remembered that, having to swim away from people in the water, singing out for help. And he couldn't help.
We were still on the plane, and my father came out of the dome where they shot out of, and suddenly, I was also hurt. And later, my mother picked me up because she was helping people exit the plane. She threw me out too, and I believe she was also injured because she couldn't swim. I had her, and then she sank away.
In this podcast series, we call Uncle Charlie an invisible hero. But through chatting to survivors and family, we're learning that being a hero comes with a price. If you survived, you survive with the memories of the attack, whether it's the parents you had before or the people you couldn't save. Being a hero means more than being selfless. It means living with the long-term effects of taking a risk. Uncle Charlie passed away in 1993, and to this day, no recognition from the Australian government has been made.
The Australian federal government hasn't recognised his deeds. The Dutch queen at the time wanted Pop Charlie to go over to Europe to receive the award. They were prepared to fly him over there. But Nana wouldn't let him. According to my mother, Nana said, no, you're not going, you're staying here. So he didn't go. This took so long to recognise the efforts of Pop Charlie, of what he did that day. And it wasn't something that came pretty freely either. And this happens, I guess, a lot with Aboriginal people, Indigenous people in the country, that they really don't get recognised until, you know, someone makes a bit of raises it to the attention of certain people and something gets done about it. But for many years, other people were being recognised for deeds of bravery or acts that are, you know, or that would have been helping someone. Pop Charlie never got any mention of it. And it wasn't until years later that when he finally did get mentioned, we thought, well, that's great, you know. Pop Charlie, what he'd done, from his point of view, you just put yourself in his shoes. He can see other people getting recognised for things, and he's not. He must have felt a little bit down about that, but who knows? We never asked him about how he felt about not being recognised.
Despite seeing Uncle Charlie as a hero, his family still sees his story as a painful reminder about what it means to be Aboriginal in this country and the history it comes with. Neville tells me about the articles written about Uncle Charlie in 1942.
And I mean, there's some of these stuff that you read and the wording of it sounds right, and like he should be almost saying that he should be acknowledged as a white person. And I thought, well, I know their heart is in the right place and they're trying to acknowledge the bravery on there, but, you know, words matter. So they use the wrong words, but I think the heart's in the right place to acknowledge the heroism that he did. They just worded it wrong. But I think all of this sort of stuff, and to get acknowledgement for something that even though he's not alive, it doesn't matter. So it would be really good to get the Australian government to acknowledge what he did. I mean, the Dutch certainly did and the King of England did. So it would be just good to get Australia to do it.
They didn't acknowledge the efforts of Uncle Charlie, the bravery of Uncle Charlie, because at the time, you know, the policy was that you know, we were still being assimilated and we were still being seen as subservient type people in Australia, and it just went unrecognised. I mean, not that we expected some huge recognition, but, you know, a letter acknowledging him for what he did and putting his life on the line for a Dutch lady and a child. I mean, that was the darkest day of the Dutch military history that day.
The family has always felt that the Australian government should have recognised Uncle Charlie's bravery. And it's not about family honour or glory. It's for a bigger reason.
Look, it's also part of this whole truth-telling too as well. This is the truth of the way Aboriginal people were treated at the time. I mean, Uncle Charlie couldn't go off to the forces because he's Aboriginal, and his younger brother, Adrian, wanted to go off to the forces, but they only allowed him to be part of the land force. So it's also part of this truth-telling. You know, Aboriginal people were involved in wars, yet their voices remained silent. This is a story about how we were treated at the time, how a young Aboriginal man was treated. It's also a story of Australia's history, Australia's military history. It's also the story of the Dutch people too as well. You know, that's this. And the Japanese. There's a lot of Japanese families in Broome that are, I think, about third, fourth generation now. You know, this is their story too as well. It's part of that truth-telling for every Australian, not just Aboriginal people.
In the next episode, we'll be speaking to people who understand what it means to be recognised.
I think he should have been exceptionally highly decorated. If it was anybody else, he might have got the George Cross, but I just don't think it suited the political environment of the time.
Recognition is important because it affirms that someone's actions really mattered.
This is Uncle Charlie, the Invisible Hero, a podcast from SBS Dutch and NITV Radio. I'm your host, Pauline Roesink. The NITV Radio team is Carrie Lee Berry, Alexis Moran, and Nari Pakai. From the SBS Audio podcast team, Joel Supple, Max Gosford, and Bernadette Fung Nam Win, this episode was mixed by Mandy Coolen. And a special thanks to PM Media for allowing us to use their interview with the late Auntie Peggy. Follow this podcast on the SBS Audio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morgen verschijnt het derde en laatste deel van deze serie. En zoals u net ook al kon horen, zijn alle afleveringen te beluisteren op onze website, in de SBS Audio app of via onze feed in bijvoorbeeld Spotify of Apple Podcast. Tussen 1952 en 1971 verbleven zo'n 300.000 migranten in Bongilla, op de grens van New South Wales en Victoria. Onder hen ook zo'n 18.000 Nederlanders. Simon Reich hoorde voor het eerst over het kamp van zijn Duitse vader, die daar ook een tijdje gezeten heeft. Het verhaal inspireerde hem om een podcastserie en een theatershow te maken over de naoorlogse migranten van Bongilla. Nu is er ook een documentaire die de komende dagen te zien is op het Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. Ik belde met Simon.
Jouw gemeenschap, jouw gesprek, SBS Dutch.
It all started with the podcast. What made you make that podcast?
Well, I did a Bachelor of Audio. So I played in a band all my life and was a songwriter. I did a lot of murals and so on. And I always did music on the side. But, you know, when I sold my songwriting business, I thought, you know what, I want to do a Bachelor of Audio. And so the capstone of that Bachelor was you had to come up with some sort of project that used audio. And so I'd already thought about this because my dad has quite a fascinating story. I mean, it's just, I can't believe some of the things, but he's got all documents and things that prove it all. Like when Hitler shot himself, my dad was only 50 meters away in a bunker in the middle of Berlin. And so they could see Hitler's bunker, and they could see all the Russians were concentrating their attacks on that, and then they just pulled the shut down, went back down in, and I'm just amazed that when the Russians finally opened their bunker that they didn't kill them all, because wow. They only survived for about a week on the water that had dripped down into the bottom of the bunker and grains of rice, which when they put it in their mouth with some water, it blew up a little bit like chewing gum, and they could last for a bit longer. But it was just endless little stories of surviving. I don't know how he did. And the things he saw were so horrific. I don't know how he's functioning as a human being, because if I saw that even on a movie, it would stay with me all my life. And that's why I think a lot of these people that I've interviewed, I want to trace back to the war. So I'm not just talking about, oh, when they arrived here, this is what happened. I want to work out, well, what were the motivations for them coming to Australia? And a lot of them said, we were so sick of the war, we wanted to find a new country that was peaceful, find a country that was as far as it could be away from what had happened in Europe. And off they went. And a lot of them didn't even know where Australia was. They didn't know anything about it because there was no internet or TV or things like that back then. And off they went, you know.
Mm. How did it evolve from a podcast to a documentary series?
Well, the podcast actually did really well in America. It won a couple of awards. And so I knew there was something here. So I went to the Bonegilla Migrant Experience, it's called, and asked them, do you have any recorded versions of migrants, of video or anything like that? And they said, well actually, we don't. And I thought, that was a travesty, you know. How could you not? You've kept the buildings, but you're not keeping the people's stories. That's more important than the buildings, I think. And so I offered myself and made a contract with them to start recording people. And so I was pitching the idea of them having listening stations where you would lift up a phone, see a photograph of what the migrant might look like when they came, and you'd listen to their story. But they said, well, actually, it might be better if you do video, because we've tried these listening stations and people don't last on them at long. If you do video, they stay longer. So I then learned filmmaking. And so then, even though I was continuing to make another podcast about Bonegilla, I actually would tape them every time I recorded just their vocals so that I had video as well. And then they put these up on televisions in the huts around the camp, and now people can come in and hear a story from start to finish about what the people that came in through the camp felt like. And that's how I ended up, this is a step before the documentary, I ended up making a live show where we would have two screens on stage, one which showed their interviews, the second one had their home movies, their photographs, documents, and then I would play on stage with a grand piano and a string quartet. And it was very emotional whenever we've played it, because if it's not just migrants wanting to come and see it, it's actually the descendants who hadn't known anything about the place, and they hadn't asked their parents, because some of them had said, I don't want to talk about that. We're not talking about the war, and we're not talking about all that stuff. Let's just think about the future. Or they never asked them. And so when this show took off and was very successful, I've just come back from Sydney, did a few shows there, done shows all around Victoria, I saw that this had legs. And so that's why I cut it up, made it a documentary, and it's actually been picked by the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival and will be screening on Friday, July the 25th at Cinema Nova in Lygon Street. So it's a great, I reckon this is great for the migrants, because it gives them voice. It tells a really crucial part of Australian history where we don't hold back anything. We let them tell the stories, warts and all. If they had trouble in the war, that we let them go for it, tell. And the boats that they came on, some of them were rusty clunkers of things and broke down. And then they copped racism here in Australia. They couldn't speak the language. It was a real uphill battle. But, boy, you know, the thing that I've found about the migrants is they were so – their tenacity was – amazing, and their will and their drive to keep their work ethic was just amazing. And they realized, hey, this country, we can actually work hard, make money and get a house quickly, you know, so, which they couldn't have done back home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the migrants you've interviewed is Ellie Duiker. She's Dutch. Let's have a listen.
Dad wanted to come to Australia because he tried to always make a life for himself in Holland. But because of the setback of my mum always being sick and TB, and he just couldn't get a, he couldn't get, have a go in Holland, for no matter what he tried. And my memories of Wernigerla, I was quite happy there. There were like big tin sheds. Not that I was upset about it. But, yeah, they're very cramped because we had two big sheds to us because we came with 10 children, and mum and dad, but they were very upset. They hated it. And then the food up there was like prison food. I was married in 1966. I have 4 children, 2 boys, 2 girls, and now I have 22 grandchildren.
Yeah, wow, big family now. I'm wondering her story. You interviewed many migrants from different backgrounds. Are they all some sort of the same? Do they have the same experience?
No, that's the thing. They you get different ones from different. Yes, I think that's what makes it so fascinating when you come and see this or you see the live show is that, yes, there are similarities, but then there are others that are quite different. And Ellie was actually one of the first people I interviewed. And I remember when I arrived, I put my recording gear out on the front lawn ready to come in, and the husband came out and he said, I don't know what you're expecting today, but she doesn't remember anything. And then I said, well, you know, my heart dropped because I'm thinking, this is my one of my first ones I'm ready to do. Yeah. I switched it on, and you know what? She just re-entered all that again because she was about 18 when she came out, so she's got very vivid memories.
Mm.
And in her case, her mother had TB and her father was trying to look after, like, work, and then she had, because they had 10 children, Ellie had to actually leave her schooling at quite a young age and look after the whole family. So it was a very tragic set of circumstances. And as you said you had in that sound clip, she said that the father just couldn't get his act together because there was no jobs. There was depression all across Holland. He wanted to find something new. But other people had actually had other experiences. Look, I have never mentioned, and I've cut them because they came here because they committed a crime and then tried to race away. and some others had big fallouts with their family because they said they would come. So that no one is exactly the same. But I think the overarching thing is that the war really did was the final push for them to say, look, you know, I was born here. I love my country. And all of them love their country. They never say, I'm sick of this country. I'm going. But the war had been the last straw. And, of course, if you looked around and saw every single house broken and burnt, you'd be thinking, well, how many years is this going to take to rebuild, and how long is it going to be till I can bring my family up and make them, you know, have them as prosperous people in society?
That country on the other side of the world, I don't know, can't be worse than this.
No. Well, I must admit, though, they pretty much all wanted to go to America. Because they'd seen Hollywood films and they thought, this is the promised land. The others were Canada, Australia, New Zealand and South Africa. So that these were sort of the splits of the countries. And some of them even had signed up to go to Canada. And then in the case of, you know, Dr. Carl from ABC, he was going to come and he got sick. And so instead of going to Canada, they said, well, you're going to be on the next ship and that's going to Australia. And they didn't know anything about Australia. But so with what their choice was, they got chucked onto another ship. So they ended up in Australia. So it was more of a, lucky dip in a way, yeah.
Mm. So for the past couple of years, Simon, this has been a big part of your life, a podcast,
yes,
a theatre show, now a documentary. Is it now time to let it go, or do you have more plans with Bond Villa?
No, I can't let it go. In fact, I've become really good friends with all of them because I just read a review of my show, the film, yesterday, and the person said, we ended up falling in love with all the people as we went through, and they felt like they were part of our family, and that's what's happened with me. I now get invitations to 90th birthday parties because they have felt a real unburdening because some of them, because they haven't told their children because of the war and the ugly bits that they went through, they held on to it for all this time. And I think, I don't know, somehow I'm very excitable and I want to learn things from them. So I really, you know, get really excited. I'll go, wow, really? You know, and I'm really just that sort of excitable guy that they end up sharing. They end up telling me things. And I think they often feel, oh, I've got it off my chest. I've let go of something. I mean, I've learned so much from them. To think that even though they went through the really hard times they went through, they still have a sense of humor. That's why it's not all doom and gloom. There is bits mixed in there that are quite funny and you'll laugh. I mean, I say you'll cry, you'll laugh, but most of all, you'll be really inspired by these gutsy pioneers who came to a country they knew nothing about.
Al dus Simon Reich, naar aanleiding van zijn documentaire Bond Villa, The Migrant's Journey. De tijd gaat snel als je plezier hebt. We zijn alweer aan het einde gekomen van deze uitzending van SBS Dutch. Onze verhalen en series zijn terug te luisteren op onze website sbs.com.au/Dutch of via de SBS Audio app. Die is gratis te downloaden via de App Store en Google Play. We zijn ook te vinden op Facebook. Volg of like ons daar. facebook.com/sbsdutch. Dan nog, over een half uurtje om 12:30 kunt u op SBS Worldwatch kijken naar het NOS 8 uur journaal van gisteravond. Dat journaal is ook te vinden op SBS On Demand. En zoals altijd sluiten we het programma af met muziek. Dit keer van Is Ook Schitterend. Nou, daar ga ik helemaal de fout in. IOS Is Ook Schitterend en het liedje heet Iedereen. Ik wens u een hele fijne middag en hopelijk tot zaterdag. Dag!
Like, deel, geef je reactie. Volg SBS Dutch op Facebook.